The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. I appreciate Richard Palmer filling in on yesterday's show, covering all of those boring topics, as he said. Actually not boring, but a lot of stories that just get ignored in the major media today. In fact, today on the program, we'll be sifting through some headlines from Europe that, generally speaking, have been ignored by the Western press, especially in the United States. The Times of London does a pretty good job of staying on top of this development. But most in the U.S. are oblivious to what's happening in Europe, to what's happening, to be specific, to what's happening in Germany. Lots to keep our eyes on there. Germany is rumbling. There's no doubt about that. And when you look at history, tomorrow, by the way, we're coming up to the anniversary of the start of World War II, September 1st, 1939. September is not such a good month when you think of World War II history. What happened on the 1st of September in 1939, and then, of course, that dreadful Munich conference at the end of September, the year before, back in 1938. We'll look back at some of that history coming up in just a bit on the program. Well, the radical left in the United States, speaking of the media, the coverage over there, the radical left and all the allies that it has in the media, they go on and on about how everything is racist. Whites are inherently racist. Republicans are definitely racist. President Trump, whom they admired just a few years ago, he's now a white nationalist. He's a racist. That's what so many are saying on the cable news networks. And it's been said before that if everything is racist, then nothing is racist. Actual racism will go unchecked. Or at least it's going to be a lot easier to ignore it or to dismiss it. A couple of weeks ago, they had it was the one-year anniversary. Speaking of bad anniversaries, the 1 year of the anniversary of what happened at Charlottesville. I forget what was that, August 13th or 14th, I believe it was, but there were something like two dozen white supremacists that showed up. And of course, the media, they were playing it up all the way through to the event because they were hoping it would be this huge rally because, of course, that would confirm everything that they believe about the United States and about the far right and how that it's spreading. Well, there was just a handful that turned out, and they left early. It was a big flop. Megan McArdle, she wrote at the Washington Post about the meager numbers. They're a far cry from the days when the Ku Klux Klan could attract 200,000 people to a rally in 1923. 200,000? I mean, that's quite different from today. She says, true, it's likely that each of those Charlottesville torchbearers represented others who wanted to march but didn't. Yet even a sizable multiplier still suggests an insignificant portion of the population. The unexpected but still small size of the Charlottesville march and its eruption into violence. She's talking here about what happened last year when I think there was 500. And quite a bit more coming from the radical left, Antifa and the like. In any event, it led to a violent explosion a year ago. Its eruption into violence made it seem plausible that there might be a growing constituency for returning to those bad old days, speaking of the 1920s. Something like the resurrection of the Klan in the 1920s. Instead, only a handful of white supremacists turned up in Washington while thousands of Americans came out to decry their hateful ideology. Now, we've written about this before. In fact, following the Charlottesville violence last August in 2017, Andrew Miller, he had an article following up that tragedy at thetrumpet.com where he said white supremacists comprise an exceedingly tiny fraction of America's population, about 0.005%. That's what it amounts to. He said there are about 6,000 KKK members in the U.S. and probably less than 10,000 Americans who are associated with neo-Nazi groups. Andrew says the Flat Earth Society has more members than the National Alliance, the nation's largest neo-Nazi organization. And there's more members of the Flat Earth Society in the United States. Well, following the flop, the one-year anniversary that was supposed to attract thousands upon thousands of white nationalists, Tucker Carlson on his program on Fox News, he said this about the media hype in the build-up to that that event. This is clip one.
Yesterday was the year anniversary of the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, in which a woman was fatally struck by a car that was driven into the crowd. If you followed the hyperventilating press coverage leading up to yesterday's event, you probably expected to see thousands of hooded Klansmen showing up on horseback in D.C. to commemorate and celebrate the killing. White supremacy is just that prevalent in America, they tell us. It's everywhere. Except it's not. That's a lie. White supremacy is not ubiquitous in America. It's not a crisis. It's not even a meaningful category. It is incredibly rare. You could easily live your entire life in this country without meeting a single person who believes anything like that. Most of us have lived lives like that. I have. In fact, this is a generous, tolerant country. It always has been that. People who tell you otherwise are either delusional or trying to control you with fear, likely both. In the end, yesterday, just a couple of dozen people showed up out of a country of 320 million people. They milled around for a while, got yelled at, and left. So much for the Klan rally.
That's Tucker Carlson from a couple of weeks ago. And in that same segment, by the way, he went on to list quite a few examples of radical left-wing violence, the kind of violence the media either covers up or justifies. Andrew Miller, in that article he wrote last year, he talked about how that the mainstream media outlets, that they're trying to sell the American public on this narrative that conflates white supremacy with constitutional conservatism. Here again, if you're a conservative or a Republican or a supporter of President Trump, then you must be a racist. You must be a white supremacist. Andrew said last year, by projecting the authoritarian racism of a fringe movement onto libertarians and mainstream conservatives, they're encouraging left-wing terrorist organizations like Antifa to attack conservative speakers at universities across the nation. And this goes on because, as I say, those in the major media, they're giving it cover. I mean, they're trying to stir up racial hatred and animosity. Everything's racism. But as I said a moment ago, I mean, if you say everything's racist, then nothing is. And then when the real problems arise, whether it's coming from the radical left in the United States or in looking at the heart of Europe today, just the other day on the program, remember the Times headline, Germany, gripped by the worst far-right clashes in 26 years. Now, this is serious. This is a headline story. You remember what happened over the weekend in Chemnitz in East Germany? That attack on that 35-year-old man, stabbed to death. And then they find that it's these migrants that have come in recent years, and that's led to these widespread protests, and they're continuing. They're continuing through this week. And I'm sure if you're in America, you hear nothing about this. The EU Observer today says that far-right and anti-far-right demonstrators were back on the streets last night. That's Thursday night. amid concerns over a possible rise of neo-Nazis at the heart of Europe. The rise of neo-Nazis at the heart of Europe. I mean, here it's a non-issue practically in the United States. You're talking about 0.005% of the populace. And meanwhile, look at what's on the rise in Germany. The EU Observer, it says, referring to the 1930s. This is quoting from the UN Human Rights Commissioner. He was in this article. He talks about how shocking it is to see these demonstrations in Chemnitz or wherever in Eastern Germany and to see all these Nazi salutes, all these Hitler salutes. It says, referring to the 1930s, the UN Human Rights Commissioner said it was frightening to see how the same devices are being used again. But it's particularly, I think, worrisome to see it in Europe because of the enormous traumas that Europe itself witnessed during the 20th century. Here's the UN of all organizations, sounding the alarm. I mean, this is chilling, given the enormous trauma that we've witnessed during the 20th century. It says here, in the wider picture, anti-EU and far-right forces are enjoying a new momentum in Europe ahead of EU elections next year. So we've got another round of elections coming up next year in the EU and also in Germany. And you see these far-right parties, they're gaining momentum. They're enjoying a new momentum in Europe. You know about the AfD, the Alternative for Deutschland, or Alternative for Germany party. It's the third largest party in the Bundestag. It carried 12.6% of the vote last year. And it's anti-immigrant. It's anti-Muslim. It's becoming more and more strident, along with other far-right groups like Pegida and the National Democratic Party. The lines between these groups, they're blurring. The Times of London, it says the Reichsbürger, or Reich citizens, are a growing worry to the authorities because many of them are armed and prepared to commit violence to further their aim of restoring Germany to the borders of the former Reich, which would include much of today's Poland. This group has 18,000 members. 18,000, and it says further on in this piece, the intelligence service estimates that the country has 24,000 right-wing extremists. 12,700 of them deemed violent. They're talking about these German elections next year and how that the AfD party could pull in something like 25% of the vote in Saxony. That's a province in eastern Germany. So what about this right wing, this far right wing momentum in Germany today? Is that a worry or a concern, particularly given the history? We'll talk about some of that in the next segment. Another one from the Times. As I said, the Times does a pretty good job here in the UK of at least covering this. But it's talking about this pogrom mood sweeping across Germany, this pogrom sentiment. And it refers to another incident that happened in the northeast of Germany, this attack on a migrant. These neo-Nazis that approached this 20-year-old victim as he was just walking through the park. And these three men started hurling racist abuse and then finally beating this young man with an iron bar across the face. He had to go to the hospital with a broken nose and bruises. This article brings out how that these three thugs, they beat up this migrant and then they took off to Chemnitz. This was like 300 miles away so that they could participate in the rallies. The far-right rallies. The Times says here yesterday, Thomas Bayer, the mayor of Wismar, this is where the attack happened, called on the city's residents to stand up against the far right, which staged the biggest riots in Germany in 26 years, referring to what happened on Monday night. This riot where immigrants were chased through the streets, beaten if they were caught. The police were outnumbered by 10 to 1. That's just happening in Germany right now. It says, we're all appalled at what has happened here. That's the mayor of Wismar. There are reasons for it. Partly that some arsonists are at large in Germany and something like a pogrom sentiment is being created. It says further on in this piece how that analysts are saying the far right has chosen Chemnitz as sort of a testing ground to see if their movement can gain momentum. And it's attracting interest from ordinary Germans who, while they might not be on the far right, they're very concerned about immigration. What's happening to their nation? Another article from the Times talks about this new book by this controversial German writer. The book's titled Hostile Takeover, How Islam Obstructs Progress and Threatens Society. So here comes this book, and it's popular. It's sounding the alarm. It's saying within two or three generations, we're going to be outnumbered. Look at the Muslim birth rates. Look at the demographics. This is a ticking time bomb, this author is saying. And who is this author? Well, he's a former member of the Berlin city government and of the Bundesbank's board. He was on the board of the Bundesbank. Imagine something like this happening in the United States and the outcry. Writing a book saying, look, we're being attacked, basically. Islam is not a religion of peace. It's a violent ideology cloaked as a religion. That's what this guy says. This is all happening in Germany. This one here. Well, I quoted this on Wednesday, and I just want to go back to it again because notice how spot on this is. This is Richard Palmer's and Brad McDonald's article from the end of 2015. This is what we were saying at the Trumpet 3 years ago. We asked, what happens when the majority of Germans realize that they've been deceived? What happens when they wake up and realize that that Miss Merkel deceived them? Our two authors, Richard and Brad McDonald, they say that, they said back in December 2015 that many, many Germans were becoming disillusioned with the mainstream parties, with mainstream politics, because they weren't addressing their concerns. Which parties are doing that? We wrote at the Trumpet, Angela Merkel's government refuses to give serious attention to these concerns and refuses to tell the truth about the impact the migrants are having and will have on the nation. And then listen to this statement. This was at thetrumpet.com. December 29th, 2015, we wrote, if she continues, that's speaking of Merkel, if she continues to do this, Germany's chancellor risks helping transform the German people and Germany itself into something very different and much more frightening than the democratic, peaceful, friendly nation we see today. These people are frustrated. They're disillusioned. And we were basically saying that they're going to turn to far-right parties because those are the only parties that are addressing their concerns. Now, that's happening. That's what's happening. The current government in Berlin, it's actually helping to transform Germany and the German people. We've talked about the Daniel 8 man and when he shows up and the spirit that's going to be behind that leadership. Well, you see the nation itself, it's being made ready for this strongman for sure. But go back to that Trumpet article, Germany, Migrants, and the Big Lie. That's by Brad McDonald and Richard Palmer. What an article. It was spot on. And we see it happening exactly the way it was played out or laid out in that article. Look at, Richard gave me another piece today, The Local. This was a German publication, I believe. This is an author who, he's been writing for The Local since 2015, just before that Trumpet article came out. And after 3.5 years there, he's leaving his post. I'm not sure where he's going. But he talks about, this is sort of his parting article, his op-ed or editorial. And he talks about how that when he started on at The Local in 2015, that Germany was, well, it was making such a good impression on the rest of the world. And Angela Merkel was popular and the economy was humming along. And well, Merkel, we wrote about this too. She was the most popular politician in the world. She could have gone on to be chancellor for 10 more years, considering the sentiment in Germany in 2015, and then all of these migrants come just pouring into the nation. And of course, initially, that got a lot of good press as well, because there was Frau Merkel just welcoming them in with open arms. And she was telling the German people, look, they're so happy to be here. They're going to be so thankful that they'll obey our laws. They'll be good citizens. Well, this is... Again, this is the editor at The Local saying that's how it was in 2015. He writes, at the same time, though, Germany has become a very different place. There is rancor and anger in the streets now. He goes on and talks about how that when Merkel goes out in Berlin or in some of those eastern provinces where she's especially unpopular, there's crowds of Germans saying she's a traitor. We want Merkel out. And then you know about the elections from last fall and the beating that her party took and the rise of the AfD and some of these other far-right groups. This fellow at The Local says, conveniently for opinion makers in the West, and he's talking about West Germany, he's talking about the press in Germany, he says, conveniently for opinion makers in the West, anger in the East is easy to portray as nationalist or xenophobic, and all things they seek to distance Germany from. He says, Germany's media elite, mostly based in Hamburg, love to shake their heads about the East. So they see these protests, they see the gaining momentum of these groups like AfD, and they just shake their heads, the elites, thinking, oh, those racists. Oh, those nationalists. And he gives an example in one German newspaper after this 63-year-old woman was raped in this small town, Bad Krozingen. Only 19,000 people live there. And he's talking about a rape epidemic in this small little community. And how that this park in the center of town, it's got like 24-hour security now. Police are there 24 hours a day because there were so many incidents of rape, migrants raping German women. That most recent, well, I forget who the one that happened in with the 63-year-old where... the perpetrator comes from, but a more recent example, two men from Gambia, they're now in jail. And then the fellow at The Local says, mainstream politicians and newspapers told Germans when all the refugees came in 2015 that the newcomers would be so grateful for the protection that they would obey the law. Even now, the broadsheet press shy away from honest discussion of the crime figures. So you have cases like what's happened in Bad Krozingen and people, residents, that are understandably outraged. And then the mainstream politicians and newspapers, they cover it up. They don't tell the truth about the crime statistics. And a lot of Germans are angry. He says, let's be clear here. If Bad Krasingan has a rape problem, then something is very wrong. People have a right to feel mainstream politicians aren't taking their concerns seriously. It should come as no surprise that people flee from all the established parties, left and right, to the only party that talks about these incidents or these crimes, and that would be the AFD. So what you're reading in the local this morning, this op-ed by the editor, who's now moving on to other things, what you're reading in the local is exactly the way the Trumpet laid it out there back in 2015. Look, what happens now when the strongman shows up? The Germans are waking up to the fact that they've been deceived. And Chancellor Merkel, she's helping to transform the German people and Germany itself, as we said in 2015, into something very different and much more frightening than the democratic, peaceful, friendly nation we see today. Now, you add to this development, this momentum that the far right is gaining in Germany, you add to that the break between the United States and Germany, and the push coming from every direction for Germany to take the lead in Europe, even militarily. They're being encouraged to do so. The Berlin Policy Journal, just the other day, would Germany lead European defense? You see how it's written. I mean, should they? Could they? Would Germany do it? I mean, is this something that could really happen? Should, could, and would are words that President Trump has explored to the full of late. It says in the aftermath of the Brussels NATO summit and President Trump's acerbic assertiveness, they are only words that Germans must consider. There can be no credible European defense without a strong German role. So that's what so many are calling for. Never mind the history from 1939. Never mind the history from the early 1940s. Never mind prophecy. Never mind what's happening on the streets. On the streets of Germany today. Never mind the protests this week or the rise of attacks, the number of attacks against migrants, or just the general discontent, the disillusionment that's set in among the German electorate that's waking up and realizing they've been lied to. Never mind any of that. Germany, you take the lead. You build up the military. You lead the other nations of Europe. That's what so many are calling for. These are earth-shaking developments that fall right in line with so many major prophecies of God in your Bible. And again, so many in the West, they just ignore it. So many news agencies totally overlook this, or they dismiss it. When we come back, we'll look at some of that history. As I said earlier, we're coming up to some anniversaries this next month. Tomorrow we come into the month of September, and looking back at what happened in September back in 1938 and 1939, these are lessons that we want to stay with us. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Herbert W. Armstrong long forecast the arrival of a military superpower in Europe. In a world where European nations can't rely on the United States, one in which they fear Russia and face the constant threat of radical terror, their only hope of survival is to band together. This is what we see happening. and what we see happening was prophesied in your Bible. Request Germany and the Holy Roman Empire to learn about the history of Germany and the Holy Roman Empire and to understand where the events in Europe today are leading. 3,000 years ago, the prophet Daniel explained that at the time of the end, radical Islam would push against Europe. That time is now. We are witnessing the first manifestations of this Islamist push against Europe, and it's leading to a spectacular clash between these two prophesied kings, the King of the North and the King of the South. What does the Bible say about the identity of these two kings? What about the end time? Will everyone be affected by these events? Request our two booklets, The King of the South and Germany and the Holy Roman Empire. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
This morning, the British ambassador in Berlin handed the German government a final note stating that unless we heard from them by 11 o'clock, that they were prepared at once to withdraw their troops from Poland, a state of war would exist between us. I have to tell you now that no such undertaking has been received, and that consequently this country is at war with Germany.
That's British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain, the announcement he made on radio. September 3rd, 1939, Britain declaring war on Germany, following after the invasion of Poland on September 1st. They sent the ultimatum to Hitler on September 2nd, and the world was at war on September the 3rd. But as so many of you know, years before this terrifying worldwide war started, there were signs all along the way. There were acts of aggression. Germany was lashing out. And even before that, defying the Treaty of Versailles, building a German Luftwaffe, an air force, 1935. And then, of course, they remilitarized the Rhineland in early 1936. And they were so weak at that point, France could have just crushed them in a matter of days. And that would have been the end of it. That would have been the end of Hitler. But nobody stood up to him. And it was all calculated. Hitler knew every step of the way. He was pinning his hopes on the fact that the Allies or that the West would not respond. And they never did. Or at least they didn't until September 3rd. 1938, early on, German troops march into Austria, virtually unopposed. And then that led up to the infamous conference between Chamberlain and his aides and Adolf Hitler and his. Hitler came in with all of these demands in mid-September. There were two or three meetings that month. It culminated in the Munich Agreement on September 30th. But Hitler came in with all of these demands. There's German-speaking people. We've got Germans in the Sudetenland. And they're being persecuted. So they need to be in the empire. They need to be in Germany. Well, Chamberlain went into those meetings, as he said to his cabinet on September 17th, the impression left on me was that Herr Hitler meant what he said. My view is that Herr Hitler is telling the truth. He believed Hitler all the way up until the war finally went worldwide. He believed him. He hoped what he was saying was true. He wanted what he was saying to be the truth. Well, the real shame in all of this, those discussions in September of 1938, was that nobody gave any serious thought to what Czechoslovakia thought. It was just Germany and Britain and France getting together and carving up this little nation for the sake of peace. And when the Czech government protested, well, they were made to look like the obstinate one. They were made to look like the problem. Even Britain criticized Czechoslovakia as being an obstacle to peace. Britain said that about the Czechs. It wasn't Germany that was the obstacle. It was Czechoslovakia. Well, the Munich Agreement, it was signed in the early morning hours of September 30th. And there were really no negotiations to speak of. Hitler got everything that he asked for. And everything Neville Chamberlain wanted, it would seem, was just a slip of paper that said the two nations wouldn't go to war against each other. And you remember the reaction of the people that were there greeting him at the airport when he returned to the UK. Here's what he had to say. This is clip 6.
This morning, I had another talk with the German Chancellor, Herr Hitler. And here is the paper which bears his name upon it as well as mine. Some of you perhaps have already heard what it contains, but I would just like to read it to you. We, the German Führer and Chancellor, and the British Prime Minister, have had a further meeting today and are agreed in recognizing that the question of Anglo-German relations is of the first importance for the two countries and for Europe. We regard the agreement signed last night and the Anglo-German naval agreement as symbolic of the desire of our two peoples never to go to war with one another again.
Never to go to war with one another again. September 30th, 1938. Well, following that, he was invited to Buckingham Palace. The king was just absolutely beside himself. He was jubilant. Peace. And then over at 10 Downing Street later on, he went out on the balcony saying, "Peace in our time." He said he had returned from Germany with peace and with honor. Well, that's not the way Czechoslovakia thought about it. Or Winston Churchill, for that matter. Churchill viewed it as a complete and total unmitigated defeat. That's what he said at the House of Commons, October 5th. Just a few days later, he said, "Our loyal, brave people should know the truth. They need to know the truth." Churchill also said, "Look, I don't grudge our loyal, brave people who are ready to do their duty no matter what the cost, who never flinched under the strain of last week. I do not grudge them the natural, spontaneous outburst of joy and relief when they learned that the hard ordeal would no longer be required of them at the moment, but they should know the truth. Our people, you could see why they wouldn't want to go to war again, given what happened just 20 years earlier. But they have been lied to. They haven't been told the truth. Truth failed in the 1930s Just as the prophet Isaiah wrote in Isaiah 59, the facts were actively suppressed. What was happening in Austria, in Czechoslovakia, in Poland? Manchester, in his book on Churchill, he said that Fleet Street withheld news and moves and countermoves in London, Warsaw, and Berlin because they knew their countrymen would disapprove. They knew the British people would disapprove. So they just didn't tell them. And then you had the head of the BBC, Sir John Reith. He would gag all of Hitler's critics, including Churchill. And yet, if someone was actually looking at what was actually happening, like Churchill was, he went over to France. I think this was in 1937 or 38. And he saw the Maginot Line. All of these troops. This was where France was supposedly going to, you know, hold its ground. But Churchill viewed the German troops across the way. And all of these Nazi mottos, one people, one realm, one leader, liberty, equality, fraternity. Manchester says, Churchill was startled by the naked intent of the German deployment, invisible to the reporter's untrained eye, but recognized immediately by him and his companion. I mean, he saw the slogans. He saw the military buildup. He heard the words of Hitler. He read what Hitler wrote. And he couldn't believe the naked intent of the Nazi machine, the war machine. It was in full motion. And yet the other politicians of his day, most of them, certainly Chamberlain's government, and definitely the media, and then the higher education, Oxford, and the university, they all concealed the truth. And so when Chamberlain came back and said, look, peace in our time. You can go and sleep easy tonight. You can sleep well this evening. You can see why everyone started cheering. I don't grudge our loyal, brave people, Churchill said, but they should know the truth. And the truth is, that we have sustained a total and unmitigated defeat. That's the truth of the matter. This is only the beginning of the reckoning. This is only the first sip, the first foretaste of a bitter cup, which will be proffered to us year by year, unless by a supreme recovery of moral health and martial vigor, we arise again and take our stand for freedom, as in the olden time. My father writes in Winston S. Churchill, The Watchman, he said, the biggest challenge we face, it comes down to this question, do we really want to hear the truth? Jesus said, you shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. I gave a program a while back using some of Mr. Armstrong's sound bites on why the truth fails, how we come to believe what we believe, taking things for granted, going along with the crowd, believing what we hopefully want to believe, what we longingly want to believe. Will we face the truth? Look at what's happening in the world today, this dangerous world. Nations all over this earth preparing for world war, preparing for the next go-round. Isaiah, the prophet, Isaiah 30 here in verse 8, God tells him to write this down on a table, write it in a book. It's for the latter days. And then verse 9, it says that this is a rebellious people, lying children, children that will not hear the law of the eternal, which say to the seers, see not, and to the prophets, prophesy not unto us right things, speak unto us smooth things, prophesy deceits. Well, the people, the masses, they do share some of the blame, as this passage brings out. This is the message that people want. They want to hear smooth things from their newspapers. They want to hear smooth things from their politicians. Churchill, writing back in 1932, this was in the Daily Mail. This is 1932. I cannot recall at any time when the gap between the kind words which statesmen used and what was actually happening in many countries was so great as it is now. I mean, I just can't believe the words you see and how different those words are from what's actually happening. You see this all the time in the media today. In a lot of ways, it's worse. I mean, you look at what was happening in the late 1930s. Hindsight's 2020. You know, well, Hitler's a madman. We see that now and think, well, how could Chamberlain wave this piece of paper? How could he sit down across the table with that madman? But look, it's happening again. Churchill said in October 1938, this was that same House of Commons speech, the people, they should have known the truth. They should have been given the truth, he said. He said, they should know that there's been gross neglect and deficiency in our defenses. They should know that we've sustained a defeat without a war, the consequences of which will travel far with us along our road. They should know that we passed an awful milestone in our history when the whole equilibrium of Europe has been deranged and that the terrible words have for the time being been pronounced against the Western democracies. You are weighed in the balance and found wanting. That's Churchill referencing a verse in, what is it, Daniel 5, I think? You are weighed in the balance and you are found wanting. God is weighing our actions and there's not enough substance or weight there. That was Churchill sounding the alarm in October of 1938, following the surrender at Munich. And listen to this, what he said in the Daily Telegraph in November of that year. By this time next year, we'll know whether the policy of appeasement has appeased or whether it has only stimulated a more ferocious appetite. Prophetic words, prophetic words there. There are the nations of the West losing another peace conference. It's like Herbert Armstrong wrote years ago. It's been aptly said that America has never lost a war and has never won a conference. Well, now we're to the point of losing wars. But we certainly don't win conferences. Following that statement by Churchill, or right around the same time, Kristallnacht, the night of the broken glass in Germany. That was in November of 1938. And then you come into that dreadful year of 1939. March 15th, Hitler just marches right into Prague. He said he just wanted the Sudetenland. That's what he promised at Munich. And just a few months later, he helped himself to all of Czechoslovakia. That was in mid-March. And just a few weeks before that, Chamberlain said, he said, I myself am going about with a lighter heart than I have had for many a long day. All the information I get seems to point in the direction of peace. And I repeat once more that I believe we have at last got on top of the dictators. Well, of course, they didn't believe that in Czechoslovakia. They were about to be overrun. They had given up the Sudetenland, thanks to that piece of paper. And then they were about to be overrun altogether. During the months that followed Germany's entry into Prague, 250,000 Czechs were killed. Over half of them were Jews. That was the nightmare. That was the slaughter going on in Czechoslovakia in 1939, even before Britain declared war. Much of it covered up. Well, we don't want to make it seem like it's too bad there, because after all, we had to sacrifice Czechoslovakia for peace. We had to do this for peace. I feel like we're finally on top of the dictators. I feel like we're finally entering into a period of tranquility. That's what the leaders were saying. I mean, even following Hitler's takeover of Prague and the rest of Czechoslovakia, still, Chamberlain held out hope that all of this could be solved with diplomacy, that all of this could be solved with negotiation. Well, and through that time, of course, Germany and Russia, they were negotiating, all right, the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. That was finalized on August 23rd, 1939. And then 8 days later, September 1st, 1939, Germany marches into Poland. And finally, Britain says, okay, we've got to, I mean, and even that, from the march on the 1st to the declaration on the 3rd, reading about those events in Manchester's history, it was astounding to just see how long it took before the declaration for war even came out. There had to be the official ultimatum, and then, as you heard, the announcement finally, because Germany ignored it. Germany was marching on Poland. Here's a little bit more from Neville Chamberlain's announcement, his declaration of war on September 3rd, 1939. This is clip 3.
You can imagine what a bitter blow it is to me that all my long struggle to win peace has failed. Yet I cannot believe that there is anything more or anything different that I could have done and that would have been more successful.
Pretty amazing statement there. He even as he had to declare war, he could not believe that there was anything more or anything different that he could have done. 60 million people, thereabouts, slaughtered in the worst, most terrifying war in the history of man. And signs, alarm bells, warnings. He said in that statement that Hitler lied. Hitler lied about his intentions regarding Poland. And the thing of it is, Hitler was lying all through the 1930s. And no one would stand up to him. There's a lot that could have been done differently. There's a lot more that could have been done if someone, if anyone, from France, from Britain, even those smaller nations, I mean, Czechoslovakia had a pretty good army for a small nation. Certainly not enough to take on Germany, not without France's help, not without Britain's help. But we found out years later in the Nuremberg trials, all of these German officers who were saying, we couldn't believe our luck. We went in, we knew it was going to be a disaster. We knew Hitler was wrong. We knew we didn't have the force, the power to march into the Rhineland, to take over Czechoslovakia. But every step along the way, Hitler knew exactly how the Western leaders would respond. He knew they didn't want to fight. He knew they were paralyzed with inaction. Even in that statement, Chamberlain went on to say how that right up until the last, he did everything possible to try to win the peace. And even after the disaster happened, even after it was now obvious, he said this in conclusion. Here's clip 5.
We have a clear conscience. We have done all that any country could do to establish peace.
Well, that's, again, he's long since died, and this is history that goes back 80 years. But these are lessons that God never wants us to forget. This is history that we want to really know and know well. History together with prophecy, because there's one more resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. And there's going to be one more massive worldwide struggle that in the lead up to it, you're going to see a lot of politicians and leaders and journalists and the like concealing the truth, because they want to say peace, peace, when there is no peace. And that's, like Isaiah said, that's what so many people want to hear. Paul said to Timothy, in the last days, they're going to turn away their ears from the truth. In that Churchill booklet, remember that statement. My father said, this is the biggest challenge we face. Will we receive the truth? Will we accept the truth? That's our greatest challenge. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today. Thank you for joining us all through this week of broadcasts, and we'll see you again next week.